Welcome to episode 121 of Photography Insights. I'm your host Andrew Walmsley and welcome to today's show. This one is entitled Lions Advertising in Action with George Logan. Now George Logan is a concept advertising photographer from London in the UK and has been shooting over 30 years. Recently he put together a book about lions with the Born Free Foundation, who work around the globe. They help and can provide sanctuaries so animals can live as normal life as possible, but never compare to the wild. George's passion with lions stems from a young age, frequently visits Kenya, Ethiopia, Zambia, Tanzania, Botswana, South Africa and Namibia. Now lions are definitely interesting animals, you all remember seeing them when visiting zoos, but to people like George, it's something they dislike and he's doing his best to keep them in the wild through his charity work. But time is short and they are rapidly coming extinct because of human behaviour. And he talks to us about the life of a lion, the Maasai warriors, poachers and conservation too. When you look at George's work, you'll see a well-executed plan and vision. One of the projects I really enjoyed of his is one of the funny ones, and it's the Costa Rica shoot for the semi-wild monkeys for IKEA. And I hope you do check them photos out. Now, we even do discuss why it's important for him to shoot the right way in this vein. And another example of careful planning was his personal project called Bad Boys that he worked on, and this was all about recreating iconic football moments with children, and this work did really well for him. It was one of the most retweeted pictures by the Daily Mirror and even made it over into Argentina as well. So in this one we're going to discuss chasing a cheetah with a Hasselblad, making images stand out, zoos effects, personal projects and belief, trajectory to extinction, seeing death, hypocrisy of helping, COVID and human interference, the importance of celebrities, dangers of shooting, and skill versus technology. And of course, we do like to have a little bit of fun, so find out why we discuss double camouflage. So please do check out all the links in the show notes. There's going to be links to obviously George's work, the charity Born Free, and obviously links to this book that he's done with them, which is obviously all in the name of Charity for the Lions. So I hope you do look at that, and obviously we'll get some images there from George on the website to make it nice and easy for you, and you can understand why I was giggling and having a bit of a laugh with some of the work he's been doing. And of course, before I move you on to the interview, I'd just like to say we're now moved into February, so my competition is now live. As of the 1st of February, my Kodakolaris competition is open. So for anyone wanting to enter that, full details are on the website, flogger.co.uk. Nice and simple competition. It's only about uploading a photo and putting a few tags and following a few people. Some lovely prizes from our friend Static Age. David Collier has hand-signed one of his books, which is obviously a wonderful prize for everyone. And I'm very grateful to James at Zone Imaging Lab, who's giving away some developing and scanning for some black and white film. So that's a very nice little thing there. So between all the zines and postcards and stickers, some lovely prizes there. So I hope you do check that out, and please pass on the word to your friends and family. I've narrowed this one down to Europe only, just because of shipping costs. But yeah, hope you like that. It's on Instagram and everywhere else. So, Let's play the music and await our lovely guest, George. And welcome to the show, George. How are you?
Very well, Andrew. Thank you for having me on.
Now, always a pleasure. And after seeing you in the iNewspaper, I took a screen grab of it and put it on my list. And I was like, I'll go back to that weekend. And I was like, reading the article. And I thought it was lovely, the approach you have.
Thank you. Yeah, no, that journalist was particularly sort of helpful with it. And I think it came over pretty good.
Yeah. I mean, as we were saying, newspapers are the best medium because obviously they're printed on such poor paper now. And that's obviously when I start researching online and you're like, oh my God, look at these pictures. And
ah, thank you. Yeah, that's good of you to say so. So, yeah, and because I come at wildlife photography from kind of left field, from a different approach, it's been really, you know, it's been a great endorsement to see it picked up and, you know, covered on the BBC and a lot of the Sunday supplements and things. So yeah, we're motoring.
Yeah, rightly deserved. And I think the other thing is, it was seeing that you had an array of imagery. So normally when you pick a photographer, they're pretty much, I'm a wildlife, I'm a portrait, I'm a wedding, and they do other things. But like, yours seem to be so varied, it was brilliant.
Yeah, that's because I get bored easily. Oh. I kind of always trying to do something a little bit different. And I've always had this urge to kind of use my imagination, and I'm more of an ideas person. So, and I've got this, you know, pressure on myself to try and come up with something that I haven't seen before or that I haven't done before, or, you know, so I'm always sort of experimenting to a degree.
No, that's good. I think that's one of the best things you can do. I think it's hard to be original, but I don't think it's hard to try something new you haven't done.
Well, totally. And the whole wildlife approach came to me quite late. You know, I originally wanted to be a sort of documentary stroke war photographer, you know, and I used to go out and cover political marches when I was first starting. And then when I did photography school, I realized my skill set was somewhere else. It was more about ideas and concepts and, you know, trying to, like I say, use my imagination. So that's the direction I took.
No, that's interesting. And obviously you've been doing this a while then. How long is it now for you? Done, George?
Oh my God, 30 years.
Oh, okay, right.
Yes, I'm older than I look. So, no, quite some while now. And like I say, I kind of came to London and started shooting conceptual advertising photography. And that's been my thing all this time. So I think I meant very good. Before we came on air, you know, I used to shoot 10-8 film and 5-4 film, and so I've come from that school, and then to edge towards wildlife photography has been quite a leap.
Yeah. Like you say, I'm not sure large format is really any good for certain types of wildlife, shall we say?
Yeah, I must. One of the first trips I did to Africa, I naively took a Hasselblad, you know, and it was, you know, the focusing system on a Hasselblad anyway, and trying to chase a cheetah at speed. And I don't think I got a single shot. I was thinking, oh, yeah, I need to take the Hasselblad. It needs to be the best quality I can do. And but that was a, you know, steep learning process. And a pretty big mistake.
No, that's fair enough. Because I have this sort of mantra where people say, yeah, you can do that on digital. You shouldn't do it on film. And I'm all for trying things. So even if it's like a constraint. So I've done a little bit of multiple exposure in the dark room. I've had no formal training. It's just messing about. And then I was thinking about like reenacting or redoing certain things maybe only my friends have done on digital and see if I could do them on film, to, you know, to push myself.
Yeah. How did that go?
It's getting there. Right. The portrait is okay because, you know, people don't move, so that's not so bad. The lighting's not so bad. They've done long exposure. But the next one would have been, like we were saying earlier, would be like racing. So whether it's cars or motorbikes.
Okay.
Now, the biggest problem is I only really have a 50mm lens.
Right, okay. Well, that's standard. That's as you see with your eye, so that's no great hardship. You can improvise.
So how hard would it be then on film compared to digital?
Shooting,
say, moving car or motorbike, like a track.
I guess mainly it's just that instant feedback that you get in digital. You know, if you got the shot or not. Same with wildlife photography. You know, I used to, after my mistake with the Hasselblad, I then shot 35mm film. And you didn't know until you got home if you were getting, you know, when the lion was leaping at the zebra, you didn't know if it was sharp, you didn't know if you'd got it in frame. So there was a massive trial and error. And to a degree, digital is kind of, you know, slightly problem is that now everybody is getting very similar shots, the equipment is getting it for them. You know, they've got a long lens, they've got high speed, and it's a lot of the time with wildlife photography, it's being in the right place at the right time, you know, when it all kicks off. So there are, you know, Instagram is full of these action shots of wildlife that people got amazingly sharp and perfectly framed. But then to stand out from that, you have to try something else.
Yeah. No, that's interesting. Because it's like you say, autofocus probably changed everything, didn't it?
Yeah, and I was just, you know, I haven't, the new sort of mirrorless cameras have got this eye lock for autofocus, which is always, you know, half the time when I'm out shooting, especially if it's action, if it's a hunt or a chase, and you're really just trying to get the eye pin sharp, and now all that sort of skill factor is taken out of it. It just locks on, and every frame will be pin. So hey ho, it's the way it goes.
No, that's cool. So I mean, obviously, one of the important things here for me is you talk about conservation. So were you a photographer before you was like into conservation, or did it lead to the other?
Yeah, it kind of went in parallel. I grew up in Scotland, and when I was very young, we moved house a lot, and I lived out on a farm. And I saw the film Born Free, and I then read the book Born Free, and I just got this fascination for wildlife. And that didn't really leave me. And strangely, when I was little, I used to go to the zoo because that's what you do if you love animals. But I'd always leave the zoo sad. And I couldn't work out why until years later when I realized that the animals in the zoo aren't what you see in the wild. They're just not behaving properly. They're basically captive. So the wildlife side of it was always with me, but then my photography went on a different tangent, shooting the conceptual advertising. And it was years later, as with all photographers, when one of the challenges is doing your own personal projects. And after a while, I realized that I couldn't shoot personal projects that I didn't really believe in. So that kind of led, I thought, well, what do I really care about? And I thought, well, wildlife, and especially lions. Absolutely fascinated, borderline obsessed with lions. So so I thought, well, how can I do something where my photography actually has an effect, a change for good? And all this sort of, there were two elements that led to my current book. One was this sort of needing to do something where my photography achieved something positive. And secondly, yeah. I was in Africa, in Kenya, and I was watching the Marsh Pride of Lions, which is the most famous, if you don't know, the most famous lion pride in the world. It's the one that the BBC use. Okay. It's in all the David Attenborough documentaries. That pride is, it's they're kind of in wildlife circles. They are the go-to lion pride. And I was watching that one night, and it was just me and my guide. We were the only vehicle. And in the distance, I saw this Maasai herder come in with the cattle illegally. They're not meant to be there. And I thought, well, if I can see them, so can the lions. And sure enough, the next morning, the lions are eating a cow. And basically what the story that I'm trying to get to is that we knew there'd be repercussions. And 3 days later, a poisoned carcass was put down. The whole pride was poisoned. And three of them died, including the matriarchal lioness. And wow. I was just thinking, well, the most famous lion pride in the world are not protected. They're absolutely vulnerable. And I'm the only person around that kind of saw this happen. I'm just thinking, and the number of lions are so low that they're on a trajectory to extinction. So this was my way of trying to do something positive, and that's when I discussed with Born Free the idea of a book, and that's where we got to.
Wow, that must have been quite awful for you then to see this, obviously this death in front of you then.
I've seen quite a lot of that.
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
I mean, that kind of, it's part, I mean, lions' lives are the whole lion society is pretty complex and brutal. So there's a lot of, you know, it's only one in four cubs will make it. You know, only one in eight males will ever become the head of the pride. I mean, it's a real brutal existence, and it's all over in a blink of an eye. They only live to 12 to 15 years in the wild, but it's everything they do. It's fascinating to me. And, the only truly social cat, they're capable of the most fearsome predator, but then they have this show of affection to each other, lions, you know, and they bond for life. And, so that fascination made me want to try and do something that made a difference.
Ah, that's lovely. So in that instance then, was it the Maasai warriors who killed them then, do you think?
we don't know. But,
okay, right.
Yeah, we don't really know. And it's...
I assume something happened.
Yeah, and it's... it's a slightly... It's a grey area because we're not the ones that have to live next to a pride lions of fear, you know, so, and to them, their cattle is their lifeblood. So it's kind of, hypocritical of us to criticize them when that is their way of survival. So, and as Europeans, that would be, we killed all our bears and wolves years ago, you know. So for us to then go to Africa and say, no, you can't build another village next to this wildlife reserve. So it's a really, really difficult, touchy subject. Human-wildlife conflict is the biggest threat to, you know, most wild animals and certainly the predators.
Yeah, but like you say, that's probably happened because we've caused this by, you know, having less grounds for them to live in.
Yeah.
You know, through ever increasing industry and all this sort of thing, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a population explosion, and I think lions now live in 5% of the habitat that they used to have 100 years ago. I mean, the numbers are extraordinary. In the 1900s, they reckon there was 500,000 lions roaming Africa, and we're now down to less than 20,000. So it's, I can see you looking shocked, because that's partly the reason that we felt, you know, we have to do what we can now. Whatever we achieve, I don't know, but I know that doing nothing is going to send them straight to extinction. So, the numbers and the decline, we're losing 2 a day. So, time to act is now.
Yeah, I mean, like you say, that's a real deadline, isn't it? The longer you wait and do nothing, the more harm comes. That's an awful thing to feel as a, you know, in a charity sort of thing, isn't it?
It is, yeah. And also, in the last week or two, we've actually, because of COVID, the pandemic, there isn't the tourism, so there isn't the tourist income for the local people. Mm-hmm. So we're hearing there's less rangers, there's more poaching. We lost 3 young male lions in snares about a month ago. This week, a lion killed one of the herders, but that's partly because there aren't enough rangers, you know, and it's a really difficult balance.
Yeah, and of course, you know, we can't understand this because we're from a different world, aren't we?
Yeah, but I think we do understand it, but then what we don't have any influence in is local politics. You know, the people want to have space to live, they want to bring up families. So again, the wildlife is getting squeezed. I mean, there are now sort of 5 major areas in Africa where there are still a reasonable lion population. All the fragmented population where they live next to people, they're the ones that we're going to lose first.
It's so sad, isn't it? Because they're such a, you know, majestic animal.
They're incredible. Yeah, they're absolutely amazing. I could watch them all day. I'm never happier than sitting, you know, bouncing out into the African dawn in an open Land Rover. If you get it right, it can feel like prehistoric. You know, you can feel like it's untouched, and you know, you're seeing the wild for the first time. And that's my happy place. That's why I'm can't wait to get back there as soon as we're allowed.
Yeah, it must be very strange that. I mean, for you to be out there in the middle of fields and remote areas, and then to be back in London, must be
hard. We were, strangely enough, at the first lockdown, we were in Kenya 2 days before international flights stopped, and it was surreal because we were the only people in the Maasai Mara game reserve. Just about everybody had been called home or got early flights home, and we sat it out, and it was quite strange because you almost saw the animals realized it, and they started to come into our camp, and you know, a hyena walked past our tent, you know, and so I don't think they'd complain about the lack of people, but just what we know the local economies there will suffer without the tourist money.
Yeah, another byproduct of all this. I mean, you know, people can talk about jobs, mental health, but there's an added effect in other countries to all this because it's an international pandemic, isn't it?
Massive, yeah. And also, I think the fact that we know that the pandemic was caused by coming from wet markets and interference in the natural world, negative interference. We know why it's happened, and I hope the message that comes out of it is that we've got to kind of look after the planet, look after the wildlife better.
I'm totally with you on that. I've said before, I hope change comes because of this. There was obviously a bit of talk of this last year about clean air, the skies looking better, and I think, was it Venice as well within 2 weeks?
I think I kind of experienced a bit of that just getting out into the countryside around London. It did feel fresher and cleaner, but I don't know if how much of that was sort of wishful thinking, but
No, that's interesting. How important are the likes of celebrities, press and media to get this message out there? Because anyone can bring out a book, but it's not just going to sell, is it, by itself?
No, and we went the full route of crowdfunding. We ran a Kickstarter. We raised £78,000 to print the book, get it distributed. And the support of Born Free, and you know, we've had people like Joanna Lumley, James Cosmo, Gordon Buchanan, the wildlife filmmaker, did us a lovely little piece where he spoke really highly about the book. So that all that really helps, as does press coverage, websites, podcasts, webinars. Mm-hmm. So it's all for the greater good. And we've almost sold out the first edition. So we're kind of motoring along nicely. We had a massive big rush on it pre-Christmas. So it couldn't have gone better.
Oh, that's really good to hear. To be honest, I've heard some really good projects coming out of Kickstarter. I think it's really helped certain people.
Yeah, I think so. It was kind of a pretty amazing process to be part of, you know, the people. And I also think partly because of the pandemic, people wanted to support good causes and wildlife, and thankfully our book project.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think TV changed, everyone was logging online, like I say, webinars have happened, we've all wanted books to read because we haven't been able to go anywhere, and things like that have been really useful. You know, even for me, I've bought a couple of books of artists and that I've come across. So hopefully I can look at yours as well. It'd be great to add it in there. But I think they all just help us and, you know, expand our knowledge of people and things around the world.
Yeah, and we were quite nervous and slightly reserved about whether we should release it this year, because we thought, people are going to be really concerned about their money. So shall we wait another year? Then we can do a live event, have an exhibition. And then we thought, no, you know, bugger it. We need to get this project out now. And I'm glad we have.
Yeah, I'm too. Because there's some wonderful, wonderful pictures. I mean, obviously, what the viewers can't see is, listeners can't see, behind him, Joe's got some lovely pictures up on the wall of some of the lions. Is that one lion in three cut into three?
Yeah, it's a triptych. Yeah. Triptych. Yeah. Kind of liked it. He's the lion that's on the cover of the book. He's known as Scarface, and he's... Okay. A complete warrior survivor, complete bruiser of a lion. You know, he's only got one eye, and no one knows how he lost his eye. It could have been a fight with another lion. It could have been a Maasai spear. Some people have said it's the venom from a spitting cobra, but he's still going strong, and he's lived his life just like a wild lion should, you know, not captive in a zoo or performing in a circus or you know, lost to a trophy hunter. He epitomizes everything that we were trying to say with the book. So I was really, and we shot him just last March when we were out there just prior to the pandemic. So I was really happy to get him.
Yeah, it's like you're like a fanboy of
Well, he's like a rock star lion, you know. He's like,
then.
people will go on, you know, a safari trip just to see that lion. He has got a he's incredibly charismatic,
Wow.
a presence about him, you know, and he's getting to the end of his days now. So, he's a must see.
Wow, that's interesting. I mean, at the end of the day, you know, like you say, when you went as a child to zoos, we all go, what does everyone want to see? A lion, don't they?
Yeah, but now when I mean I've actually gone to zoos a few times recently, but kind you know yeah shooting them for different reasons. But the sight of a big male lion patrolling a tiny enclosure roaring is just one of the saddest things to my eyes. You know, it's just he should be in 100 square miles patrolling the whole, you know, that's what they do. And the demeanor between a wild lion to one that's captive, it's not the same animal. And I always end up coming out of zoos sort of apologizing to the animals that are there, you know. So I'm not a fan.
No, I understand that. I think we all feel the same, that we'd all love animals to be in natural habitats, but because of us humans, we're destroying it all, aren't
Yeah, totally.
we? So that's our lovely thing we love doing. You maybe thought after a few, I don't know, 5, 10,000 years, we'd have figured this out,
It's gone the other way.
but yeah, and I think a lot of it is in a very short time and space as well, isn't it?
Well, that's right. That's part, you know, the last 100 years have decimated the wildlife population, and especially the big cats. You know, tigers down to 3,200, I think it is, and cheetah 7,000 left in the world, you know, wild. So and what I don't get is that the alarm bells aren't ringing more, because when I think what I touched on, when I go, everyone thinks that there's an army of conservationists out there looking after the animals, but there really isn't. You know, there really isn't. And much as I love the wildlife documentaries, I think they somehow give a false impression that there are more animals out there than there actually are. You can drive around the Masai Mara or South Luangwa, some of the places that lions are meant to be plentiful, and you won't see one for half a day. You actually need to have a guide and an understanding where they're likely to be, or you won't see any. There are so few left.
It must be incredible. Yeah, must be pretty scary for you, because I mean, obviously, you've been going back for years as well, haven't you?
Yeah, the images in the book were shot over the last 10 years, and I think we've mostly in Kenya, Tanzania, Botswana, Namibia, South Africa, Ethiopia, Malawi, Zambia. So I've covered most places where there is still a good lion population, but and even in that time, each time I go, I see fewer lions and more human settlement coming up around the edges of the parks. So yeah, unfortunately it doesn't look good, but it's not without hope, because with lions are the most resilient creatures, and we know that given space that they can bounce back. And the one thing that they do very well is breed. You know, so and we've got, you know, just given space and prey species, and you know, and less human intervention, they can bounce back, but it needs to happen quite quickly.
Do you think that though needs like a managed ecosystem where we still have to introduce prey for them, and we then have to protect another species and that sort of thing?
Some of the some of the places I visit are managed,
okay,
and some are just completely wild. So, I mean, the preference is wild, unfenced, but realistically, that's not always workable. So, some are managed where they have to keep the balance right.
Yeah. I think that's the wild element, like when you're watching documentaries, how much of it is real, or are they, you know, purposely, I don't know, slaughtering an animal, or are they purposely sticking an animal where it shouldn't belong?
No, that doesn't really happen. I think that's not something to worry about. It is just the other issue, if you know, with lions, is they're sort of silently being eliminated. You don't see the pictures of them being, you know, like you see with an elephant that's being poached with its tusks off, or a rhino.
Yeah.
You don't see the same images of lions because they're usually, I hate to say it, but they're usually poisoned out of sight or speared or, you know, trapped.
Mm.
And so sometimes when I go, there'll be a pride and I'll ask the local guides and they'll just go, oh, nope, three have disappeared, and they just have gone, you know. So that's something else that we have to try and address.
Okay. I mean, what involvement does the foundation have then, from obviously not just raising money? Do they go on go to Africa and help, or what do they do?
Born Free are not the biggest wildlife charity, but I believe they're the kind of hardest hitting. They're quite small, but they really punch above the weight, and they operate all around the world. There are many sanctuaries where they will rescue animals and take them there. Last year, there was four young lion cubs that were found in France. One was in the back of a Lamborghini driving around Paris, and he was obviously confiscated. And Born Free took them from France back to Africa, and they'll never be able to be set free, because they couldn't fend for themselves. But they've got very naturalistic sanctuaries, so those lions will live out their life the closest you can get to being free. So they do that, and then also we go into schools, local schools in Africa, and the places that are usually bordering the wildlife parks, and they're in. You know, Born Free will get involved in educating the local children, not to, you know, the animals that are next door are kind of
preserved.
Yeah, they're so it's on many planes, and they've got teams that will go tracking lions, getting rid of snares, anti-poaching patrols. And I noticed one of your questions, you were asking about the anti-poaching patrols, and we kind of quite often find that a lot of the people involved in those are ex-poachers. You know, it's a kind of weird, you know, where they've been caught and allowed to turn their life around, and then they become the ones protecting the wildlife. So it's a complex world out there.
Oh, I mean, it's got to be, hasn't it? I mean, it must be like most parts of the world. What's the easiest way to earn a living? It is going to be what you do, isn't it? Not necessarily the best for the planet or yourself.
Yeah. When I first started going to Africa, I actually found that a lot of the people that owned the safari camps and ran safari businesses used to be hunters, you know, and then they suddenly realized that that's not sustainable. And they've taken the decision to, you know, become involved in conservation or, you know, running safari camps.
No, that's nice. So for you to go take pictures then, how does this work? Are you like assigned a job by an agency, a newspaper, a magazine, or are you going for yourself?
No. I don't make any money at all from going to Africa and doing the wild. I my career, shooting my advertising conceptual photography, has been quite successful. So that subsidizes me to do something that I really love, which is
Right.
going off to Africa 4 or 5 times a year and hopefully doing something positive and contributing. The work that we do with Born Free, we shoot all their campaigning work. Some of the campaigns have had amazing results. There was one that was credited with an EU ruling, with helping influence an EU ruling banning the import of trophies, animal trophies like heads.
Wow.
And so
Yeah.
something like that is amazingly satisfying to be involved with, because that means that it's having a really positive effect.
God, that's amazing. Yeah, you've got to be proud of stuff like that,
Totally. Yeah, I am.
haven't you? Yeah, no, that's awesome.
But yeah, it's a no one really commissions me to go off to Africa to photograph lions. I have had a few jobs. The one that was a dream shoot for IKEA. We went to Costa Rica, and in the jungle, in the forest, we built an IKEA kitchen, and then we waited for the monkeys to come to the kitchen and film them. And these were semi-wild monkeys. They lived in a sanctuary, but they'd go into the forest during the day. And so we got to do that completely for real. I have a real aversion to shooting wild animals in studios. I just won't do that. So this was done the right way. We went to them. We got a pretty amazing picture, I think, and or series of images. And it was done the right way. We didn't have to bring them into a photographic studio that's completely unnatural to them. So, and then I've also done a couple of shoots where we have gone photograph leopards, lions, cheetahs, zebra, but always in the wild. When I first started working in London, I did do a shot where we used an animal handler. We got a zebra in a studio. And it was one of the most traumatic things I've ever witnessed. The animal was so distressed. It was slipping and sliding around. And I thought, well, I'm not doing that again. And I've turned down so many jobs over the years where people think, oh, George shoots wildlife, so let's get him to shoot, a leopard in this car or something. And I just won't do that.
Oh, good on you. That's really nice, mate. Yeah. I don't think everyone will be turning that down. Because work is work to some, isn't
Yeah, well, it really pains me to turn it down as well.
it?
I've also had to turn down shoots for zoos. I just can't do it. Can't do it.
No, that's understandable. I mean, I loved the IKEA shoe. I mean, what sort of monkeys were there?
Oh, Capuchin and Howler. There was three different types that kept coming down. Without looking at the picture now, I can't quite remember them. But yeah, we were in full camouflage nets over us with just the lens popping out, and we just had to sit there and wait for the monkeys to come and get the shot, So yeah.
It looked because obviously, without knowing you, Pammy, and talking to you just look at that shot and you're like, has he done that in a studio?
And yeah.
Because you could have easily photoshopped that like jungle photo as well.
Yeah, no, we didn't. No, I promise you, we definitely didn't.
No, that's cool because like the water ones, it made me laugh where there was one who was sort of like stood on a glass and it's like the old slapstick from the 30s and 40s when you're trying to run on a barrel.
Oh yeah, I know the shot you mean. Yeah, they were great. Yeah, and it was
That's
really well
incredibly fine.
received, and quite rightly, the agency and the client made quite a big deal out of the fact that they'd done it the right way, like gone there, no damage, no sort of yeah, no negative effect on the wildlife at all.
That's great. And why shouldn't you use that? You know, if your company is doing good and getting messages out there and still earning, you know, money or whatever from it, then everyone does well out of that, surely.
Totally. Yeah. No, I think the days of, you know, like it was, I think that used to be the PG Tips chimpanzees, you know, those adverts. And that's all, you know, we've got to be better than that. We can't photograph wild animals in that way now. And I don't want to see a polar bear or a tiger or, you know, wolf even in a studio, you know, just don't do it.
Yeah. I think there's a lot of lessons we can learn from our pasts and, you know, even in our lifetimes, isn't it, that we've got to do better. We've had 20 years now, maybe 30 years of seeing damage caused by climate and using things for the wrong reasons.
I agree, yeah. And, yeah, it's one of my bugbears is seeing, you know, close-ups of animals in studios that are then, you know, or they're an exotic prop for a pop video or a passed off for a fine art project or something. No one stops to think where that animal has come from or what existence it's got. And it's usually off to, you know, off to live in a bunker somewhere or, yeah.
Yeah, because it's to me, that's like no different from saying taking a child from Africa. Right, I need an African child. We need them on the TV. Get them into Britain. Let's do some interviews and stuff. Well, that's not necessarily the right thing to do either.
No.
You've got to have people in the right environments, haven't you? But then photos. Yeah, I loved. There was two or three, and I was laughing my head off where they're spraying water over each other.
Yeah. Yeah, no, they really went for it. It was because it was something fresh and new to them, and and then once they were bored, they cleared off, you know, and back into the trees, and yeah.
No, it's funny. I mean, who was that, a conceptual idea by someone, or is it just something you all agreed on? Or?
Yeah, it was an agency called Mother, and IKEA briefed them. And then came to me because they knew of my background of photographing wild animals and sort of conceptual. So it was a perfect match. Unfortunately, there aren't quite enough shoots like that, you know, so they're not always much fun as that one.
That's fair enough. Do you think it's like your knowledge of Africa then comes in handy for these sort of things?
Yeah, it definitely does on some things. And but like I say, probably not as many as I'd like. I'd love to get over there. I mean, we go there and photograph the Born Free campaigns all the time, and that is incredibly important to me. That's the work that I am most proud of. And also that the conceptual photography that we do with animals, we just thought you kind of have to take a slightly clever approach. It has to engage people. It has to be thought-provoking. I don't think you can just keep showing graphic images of animals that have, you know, suffering. So we always try and come at it a slightly different approach.
No, that's good. Like you say, you've got to be different, haven't you? Because there are many charities out there. Everyone needs the money. And some of them are doing similar things, so it must be really tough.
Yeah. Yeah, I think they're finding it very tough now. All charities are, you know, I think, everyone is. So, yeah, it's a tough time.
I mean, for you, like, going shooting wildlife, obviously, there's things involved. You've got planning side of traveling to another country and where you stay and all this stuff. You can have your equipment. It does, like, any mental preparation come into this as well?
Yeah, but I love it. So it's something that I'm kind of like I say, there's nothing better than just hearing out into the African dawn, you know, just see what dramas have unfolded in the night, you know, and and you know, we now shoot with a proper film vehicle with a whole side of it is open. So I'm completely, I'm down on the floor with the camera hanging out, and you just, it's a wonderful experience. And you're just seeing, you know, the most of the predators hunt at night. So when you're out in the morning, you're seeing incredible dramas unfold. It's, it's my favorite thing.
No, that's cool. I mean, there's two things I want to ask you there. So do you ever feel in danger yourself then?
When I first started photographing, especially the big cats, the lions, there's an obvious, you know, you're obviously slightly apprehensive, but then you realize after a while that you're not on their menu. They don't see you as prey. And I think partly because, like, lions have evolved to know that when they come in contact with people, they're likely to come off worse. You know, perversely, they've got a lot more to fear from us than we do them. So, but it does, it is a bit of a heart and mouth moment when they come right up to the lens, and they do with to touching distance even, you know, so, and I've got a few shots of me sort of hanging out the vehicle with them right there, you know, so it's, but I love that. And, there have been a few sort of close encounters. I mean, they do lions especially will do a thing called a mock charge, where the big males will charge towards you, but then they pull up. So they don't, I've not had one that's followed it through yet, otherwise I wouldn't be sitting here talking. they don't want you there. It's usually when they're mating, or occasionally we know a few big male lions that we shouldn't get too close to, so they can get a little bit hostile, but nothing too scary.
Have you learned these mannerisms then, and know when to go away?
I know the language of it. With most wild animals, you'll get a warning. You know, if it's an elephant or a rhino or buffalo, you know when you need to back off. So I can generally read the body language quite well. And likewise, I've kind of started to understand when they're likely to hunt, or when there's going to be some sort of interaction. I can usually spot it. And then as a photographer, the trick is where you position the vehicle. If it's a hunt, you think, where can I be when the action happens? Where is the light? Is the sun going? You know, one of the worst thing is, because a lot happens at dusk. So one of the worst things is when the light goes just as the action happens and you miss it. And I'm sure in the future, once you know, once the cameras get even more sophisticated, we'll be all out there photographing night photography. You know, so
yeah, I think so. I think that side of technology is changing us, because I know my last interview that just came out yesterday, she talked about slavery, and what she was doing was taking photos of places at night.
Right.
She was no expert on photography, and she realized how much noise was in her shots.
Yeah.
And then she was saying she was looking at ways of getting past this, but she knew long exposure causes it. So then she'd buy the next iteration of the camera and wait a couple more years and then next. And I find that quite interesting, that an artist has had to wait for technology to be able to catch up.
Yeah. Yeah, it's funny you should say that, because I think coming from shooting purely film, a night shot used to be one of the most technical things, because you had to, you know, calculate your exposure. You had to, you know, build in reciprocity failure, or if you're flashing, you had intermittency effect, how many flashes build up. And And now you just set auto, and wait for it to happen. And it used to be a real skill doing a night shoot, and now it's kind of, people are getting it on their phones now, and it's looking pretty good. So everybody's a photographer.
And I know we don't really want to talk technology because it's not what either of us are interested in. But you have to mention a little bit. I mean, because it's obviously changing the way. So, for instance, what size focal length are you doing a lot of this work at?
I shoot on all for I take my go-to for action is a 400 mil, but occasionally we go longer. But I always take a lot of wides as well, because it's very important to me that you get a sense of place, and you get the landscape. The atmosphere is also very important. So I need to be able to capture on all focal lengths, and when I arrive at a scene or a sighting, I have to instantly decide what it is I want to get. So I'd usually try and get the thought in my head, the image in my head, and then find a way to do it. There is a fascination with wildlife photographers. Everybody's shooting on the mega what long lens, wide open, and you do get these super crisp, action shots, but they can look a little bit soulless, so it's a tricky balance. But in my book, I think I covered everything from super wide angle to don't think there's any fisheye in there, but generally I want people to understand where the animals lived, where the lions lived. But then obviously you can't get too close without using a camera trap or a camera on the ground. So it's use whatever.
No, that's interesting. I think that shows in your portraiture as well, because I'd say some of them are more environmental portraits.
No, it's whatever idea I've got in my head, imagination wise, it's then finding the equipment to create the image. So I kind of work backwards from usually from a sketch or an idea, and just find the kit that works. So I don't go with a preconceived idea of how I'm going to get something. It's always a bit of experimentation.
No, I like that, because obviously what I really love was like the London
Oh,
derelict.
derelict London, yeah.
Oh,
Well, again, that was personal project work, and again just trying to do something that I thought was looking fresh and new. So we sourced those locations, and I think a couple of them are like the old Central St Martin's College, and there's a few derelict warehouses, and then I can't help myself, but I always have to inject some sort of storytelling into the images. So then I sort of cast the characters, and those are the results that they in that sequence.
It for me it's the same. I love the derelict stuff. I'm doing a project myself.
Okay.
But these are like pristine places, or you've put really awful places and then you've put the models in there. And I thought it was such a great combination, to be honest.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, that's that means it worked. Yeah, no, it's that as photographers, our personal project work is the most important thing we do, because that is our that's the things that we're passionate about. And like I say, I can't, if I don't feel connected or involved in a project, I don't do a very good job in it, I think. So it needs to be something I really believe in to make it work.
No, I understand. I think it's something I've just started to learn, because I haven't been in photography too long. It's been nice that I've already found two sort of personal projects to do, and it becomes part of who you are and people recognize you from that.
Yeah, I agree. Well, stick with it. And I can't recommend just getting a sketchbook out and sort of trying to, you know, trying to create your ideal end result in your head and just sketch it out and work backwards from that, you know, rather than relying on a happy accident or, you know, something happening on the shoot. I think you need to, need to sort of think it out.
I like that. The only thing is, if I do that, everything's stick men.
Yeah, well, me too. My sketches are shocking, you know. It's part of, I'm never going to be an artist.
That's fair enough. And obviously, one of the other projects, because I've always played football all my life till recently, and seeing these bad boys. Yeah. I mean, where did that come from?
Well, I didn't come up with that idea, but it's two creatives called Daz and Tom, we work in New York now, came up with this concept, and we all got together and loved it, the idea of creating these iconic moments in football where, you know, like, you know, somebody's been bitten or someone, the headbutt, or Maradona's hand of God. And it was such fun to do. We went out on Hackney Marshes and we got all these kids and we cast kids that looked like, you know, we had a real skinhead kid for Zidane.
Yeah.
Maradona's this curly-haired little dude that loved jumping up and down on a trampoline. So, we're super happy with the end results. And I think the Daily Mirror said it was their most retweeted feature ever. And when Maradona died recently, my agents put that picture up again, and we got so much interest in it, especially from Argentina, funnily enough. You know, the people picked up on it and ran it in blogs. But they were really fun to do, really fun.
Yeah, I bet the kids loved in taking part as well.
They really loved it. We did have a slightly sticky... because there's a Robbie Fowler one where...
exactly the one I saw, yeah. And I was like, I wonder if he realises what he's done here.
We were incredibly concerned about that. In fact, we had to stop it being run because we're worried about the kid getting recognised. You know, Robbie Fowler's down there sniffing the line off the white line of the pitch. And we recreated that image and... it makes me howl when I look at it because the kid was so into it. And even his parents were. But then we had this sudden, like, what if his school sees it, you know? And we show it now. But at the time, we had to, because the images were all used in, like, the Sun and the Mirror. The tabloids loved them. So we were very wary about them generating too much bad publicity. So we had to pull back on that.
No, I understand that, and I think that must be one of the hardest things, is to reflect and think about what you could potentially be doing.
Yeah, but also it was such a good project to have our portfolio on. It led to, we got a commission from Adidas to shoot, you know, with we had the footballers, bad boys in our presentation, and it helped get us that commission shoot. So that's the you know, it's good how it works like that.
Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah, I think it's something different though, and it's not the fact you're celebrating what they did, it's just you're either having a laugh or it's just that sort of thing, isn't it?
We were having a laugh, but then at the same time, our kind of, you know, attention to detail. To make to make sure the strips were right, to make sure the body positions were right, so that they were instantly recognizable to people who know football. But even, you know, we wanted it to have an appeal to anybody that looked at the images. So, that was a fun one.
God, I'd love to do something like that. These are the things where you think these are pure genius moments.
Yeah. Well, I really can't take credit for the idea. That was, like I say, my friends, Daz and Tom, creative team.
Yeah, but everyone's part of the process, aren't they? That's what I
Indeed.
say.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it's nice that you can celebrate what your friends did as well, because
Exactly.
that's what it's all about, isn't it? Looking after each other.
Indeed.
So we are through the final, the formal part of the interview, George.
Okay.
So what I'd like to do is a couple of my silly random questions with you.
Fire away. Bring it on.
It looks like you'll take these with a pinch of salt easily anyway. You're that character.
No worries.
Okay, so there is a new fashion law, you're gonna love this, and you have to choose between double denim, shell suits, or tartan.
Tartan, obviously.
Obviously.
That's a no-brainer.
See, I picked the perfect person, didn't I?
I think at college I used to get in trouble for doing double camouflage. I was so broke that I lived out of the Army Navy store, so I was just wearing military gear the whole time. But tartan, obviously.
Got it. Brilliant. Now, would you rather meet Dr. Pepper, Dr. Doolittle, or the Doctor, as in Doctor Who?
Doctor Who, I love her. I can't remember her
Yeah.
name right now.
No, I can't. Do you know what? That's the only series I haven't yet seen.
Right. Okay. Yeah. No. Definitely. Oh God, I can't remember the actress's name, but she's. Yeah, she's fantastic.
Oh God. I think it's been a fabulous thing from all our, through our lives, hasn't it?
Yeah. I'm a big Dalek fan.
Oh yeah. Same here, yeah. I love them.
Unfortunately, I usually want the Daleks to win, and they never do.
Now, sometimes it looks like it, doesn't it? And then just at the end.
Yeah.
Okay, your next one, I think I pretty much know what you're going to say. So, if you could have the skill of an animal, would you have the sight of an eagle, the longevity of a turtle, the ability of an amphibian, or the prowess of a tiger?
I can't believe you said tiger and not lion.
I know I should have changed that, shouldn't I? I'll edit that out. The prowess of a lion.
Yeah, oh, lion all day, because even though it's that short, brutal existence, it's the glory, you know. I watch them so much that yeah, I'd be I'll be coming back as a male lion.
That's cool. No, I like that. Mr. Men and Little Miss were popular children books. What title would you add?
Little shit.
Yeah, I don't think there was one, was there?
Little bastard, I think.
Yeah, there's.
No, I don't know. I don't know who don't know what your
Yeah.
age group listening is, but
Oh no, you're fine.
yeah. Little bastard.
Yeah, a little bath. Yeah, I like that. Yeah, I think there's room for one then. Let's face it, we're in a different world than that now, aren't
Totally. Totally.
we? Yeah. Okay, so the Universal Language Translator is featured in many science fiction films, but will it look like the Babel Fish?
Oh, it's a while since I've seen The Hitchhiker's Guide, but I know what the Babel Fish was. No, I think it'll be ethereal. I think it'll be a more of a floaty, probably not, you know, not a three-dimensional thing. I think it'll be in the
Okay.
ether.
Ah, so you don't think it'd be like an implant or anything like
No, I think it'll happen in the airwaves.
that? Okay. That's clever. Yeah, I like that. Because I was just thinking straight away. I just think we learn, like, people learn languages, so and we learn it through computers and stuff. So surely it would be easier if we just had some sort of device that translated for us.
Yeah, it'll come. Well, our phones nearly do it now, don't they? So
it's... they're not bad, actually. Yeah. Yeah, not bad at all. Yeah, no, I like that. Well, thank you so much for going through that, Jazz. That was
thank
very
you,
good
Andrew.
Fun.
It's been a pleasure, and I hope you got everything you needed.
No, that's great. Do you want to remind everybody where to check out your work and Born Free as well?
My book is called Lion, Pride Before the Fall by me, George Logan. The Born Free Foundation can be just found if you search it. They're big. www.pridebeforethefall.com is all. It's the book's dedicated website with lots about Lions, myself, and the charity Born Free, and our plans with the funds that we raise from the book.
That's wicked. Thank you for that, mate. And obviously, I'll put links in the show notes for everybody anyway.
Fantastic. Let me know when you're going out.
No, I will do. Not a problem. And then my final question is, I do this pay it forward scheme where I like people to recommend someone I maybe should check out. Maybe it's someone you really like, you find interesting. It could be a totally different genre. Any ideas?
Well, my assistant, Felicity Crawshaw, is a real up-and-coming young photographer. She's very good. Dean Marsh is another good friend of mine. We started shooting very atmospheric pictures of the French landscape.
Okay.
Great.
Right, well, thank you so much for your time, George. I really appreciate that.
Thanks a lot, and good luck with it. And, keep in touch.
No problem. Yeah, we'll do. Good luck with the foundation, mate, and thanks for all you're doing.
Thanks a lot. All right, cheers, Andrew.
Hey guys, thanks for all listening to that episode. I hope you enjoyed it. It's very nice to see the listening figures are picking up. We've seen more and more people register on the website. So thank you all. It really is appreciated. Obviously, the biggest thing you can do is share the show with like-minded people. And if you could submit any of your reviews, I'm putting them on the show. For anyone wanting to leave a review, I've made it as easy as I could for you. So if you're listening on iTunes, just go to itunes.flogger.kuk. If you're on Spotify, just go to spotify.flogger.kuk. iHeartRadio, etc. They're all the same. And if you go to reviews.flogger.kuk, it will take you straight to the Facebook page where you can leave a review. So I've made this all very simple for you. Let's keep the support going. Please keep sharing, and I look forward to bringing you the next one. Thank you, everybody.